This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 23rd of July, 2021.
Many Boomtown axed over virus. Boomtown's Boom Village has been cancelled, organisers have revealed. They announced last Tuesday that Boom Village, due to take place on August the 12th to the 15th, has been cancelled due to, quote, escalating cases of COVID-19 across the country, unquote. It had been a scaled-down version of the annual festival with tickets aimed at local people. Organisers said in a statement on their website, "We are truly sorry to have to say this again, but we have had to make the incredibly hard decision to cancel Boom Village. These past few days, we have been back in the excruciating position of weighing up every possible scenario to see how we might be able to proceed. There is so much excitement out there for us to come together and host this beautiful festival, but sadly, they outweigh all the wonderful reasons for going ahead. The core decision is due to the escalating cases of COVID-19 across the country, and the risks that widespread illness and self-isolation could have on our crew and contractors, which would result in us not having enough people to build and deliver the show to the high public safety standards we uphold." They added that they will refocus back onto Boomtown 2022. All ticket holders have been contacted directly via email about their automatic refunds. The news was welcomed by some local people who have long been unhappy about the event. Michael Beer of Petersfield Road, Cheriton, said, "It would appear that Boomtown have been unable to sell enough tickets for Boom Village. This is why that has been cancelled. And their story about being worried that their staff and contractors might contract COVID or get pinged is just a convenient cover story to get better PR. Its cancellation is good news for the local wildlife and for people who live in the villages which surround the site and who enjoy the scenic beauty and dark night skies, all of which would have been adversely impacted if the event had taken place."
And the third one is Crop Circle appears overnight in Upham, and this is accompanied by a beautiful picture from above of a huge crop circle, very elaborately done, very symmetrical, with lots of squares cut out and a big circle in the middle, a kind of broken circle in the middle. And this is really lovely. And the story says this crop circle has appeared in a Meon Valley village. Close to Peak Lane in Upham, in a private farmer's field, the design was first spotted over the weekend. It's likely to have been completed on the Saturday night or Sunday morning, according to photographer Matt Adamiak. "The only access to view the work is via drone," claims Matt, who has expressed his concern over potential damage to the pattern. He told the Chronicle, "Apparently there is a COVID meaning to us. As yet, I haven't had that confirmed. Sadly, once this is common knowledge, it will be ruined, no doubt by people wanting to get inside it. I have no idea how this appeared. I like to think aliens, but it's more than likely men with planks of wood." In the 1980s and early 1990s, there was fierce controversy over the cause of the circles, with some arguing that they were made by extraterrestrials, others that they were made by the weather, and others, the majority view, that they were man-made. And that concludes the headline stories. We will now continue with death notices, then Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, Belgarum diary, first person, editorial comment and letter from Westminster. We'll end with items of general news, and I will start with the death notices. Bigley, Dorothy Bigley, died peacefully at home on age 99. Daubeny, Cynthia Daubeny, passed away peacefully on the 4th of July, aged 74. Goodchild, Gwendolyn Mary Goodchild, passed away at the Midlothian Community Hospital, Bonnyrigg, on 23rd of June, 2021, aged 92 years. Moreau, William Lionel Pops Moreau, died on the 16th of July. Wadham, John Ronald Wadham, peacefully at home on the 3rd of July, aged 86 years. And finally, Woolford, Margaret June Woolford, on the 8th of July, passed away after a long illness, peacefully at home in Winchester, aged 79 years. And now we're going to Christian Comment from John.
And this week, Christian Comment is written by Nigel Hemming, who is the senior pastor, Winchester Vineyard Church. And he entitles his piece, Leadership Standards. Despite the heartbreak of losing in the final, England's endeavours at the recent European Football Championships gave many of us something to cheer about after months of COVID gloom. Following decades of failure at international level, Gareth Southgate has been a key architect of the team's success. After their semi-final win over Denmark, pundit and former player Gary Neville commented, "The standard of leaders in this country in the last couple of years has been poor. And looking at that man there, Southgate, that's everything a leader should be. Respectable, respectful, humble, tells the truth." In the wake of the United States presidential election last autumn, I wrote about the importance of character across all leadership contexts. And here again, very publicly, is a shining example of humility and honesty which has captured the heart of the nation and led to significant results. The Apostle Paul, writing to his protege Timothy, describes the qualities to look for when appointing leaders. The list in 1 Timothy 3 is particularly striking because of the high emphasis he places on character compared with raw skills. Paul insists that a leader must be above reproach, faithful in marriage, sober-minded, self-controlled, gentle, respectful, hospitable, and have a good reputation with the community. By contrast, he only really names one specific skill in this list, namely that they must be able to teach. Clearly, a leader's skills and experience are important, but their character must also count if they hope to be a role model or example for others to follow in any context. Leadership is influence, and the way a leader acts, their personal integrity and how they treat people will always be a huge factor in how successfully they can take people with them on their journey. Paul very much thought of himself in the role of a father, describing Timothy as a dearly loved son. The best parents love their children unconditionally while calling them to greatness, disciplining them where necessary and guiding them as they grow. More than a boss, a commander or a teacher, the analogy of a parent best fits the biblical model of leadership, and Paul writes about both his motherly and fatherly characteristics in 1 Thessalonians. "We were never patronising, never condescending, but we cared for you the way a mother cares for her children. With each of you we were like a father with his child, holding your hand, whispering encouragement, showing you step by step how to live well before God." Southgate's fatherly qualities are an obvious part of his management style. He is the first to console a young player after their penalty failures, even if they're on the other team. He takes responsibility for his own mistakes whilst allowing his players to take the credit for their success. He is clearly admired and well respected by his talented young squad. And as Gary Neville so clearly pointed out, leaders from any sphere would do well to learn from his example.
Thank you. Now we'll continue with letters to the editor. If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by telephoning 01962 860 836 or emailing news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk or writing to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO238AL. There are 13 letters this week, and I'll start. First of all, letter about Martin Biddle from John Robinson. Sir, history, archaeology interest me greatly. I have previously donated an Acheulean hand axe to the museum, and so, like you, I was intrigued to read what Professor Biddle has to say in last week's paper. He has an international reputation and is pretty well top of his field, so his views might have considerable weight, and even though it may play merry hell with redevelopment plans, the idea of a Roman amphitheatre is intriguing. However, there is a downside even to the good professor in that, as I understand it, he has yet to publish his final reports on his previous digs. The term de Biddle is apparently used by some archaeologists to refer to persons who somehow never get round to setting out their findings to the general detriment. I hope I can be proved wrong on this. John Robinson, Springvale Road, Kingsworthy.
Martin Biddle. Sir, how good to read that Professor Martin Biddle is pressing to have a proper archaeological exploration of the Central Winchester Regeneration Site. Good to see in the editorial that the Chronicle supports this, and hugely welcome that the editor is able to say so openly that the paper was wrong to encourage development of the previous scheme that would have resulted, as he says, in a white elephant. Professor Biddle's series of Winchester studies is internationally renowned, as is his reputation. The City Council's members and officers must surely pay attention. Everyone who wants to see a flourishing city emerge from the pandemic must hope that he will succeed, where so many of us mere campaigners have so far failed. The obvious result of a thorough dig would be that the findings would dictate the development. This could mean everything from the display of an amphitheatre to, as he says in the article, new buildings designed and located so unavoidable impact, lift shafts, service trenches, and also the placing of any taller buildings and consequent design of foundations causes the least possible disturbance. The current proposal to sell the entire site to a single developer, despite earlier plans and pleas to the contrary, would endanger such a subtle approach. A monolithic development is seldom the answer to any problem, but especially not in a city where the layers of his... I'm sorry, can't I do... Martin Biddle. Sir, how good to read that Professor Martin Biddle is pressing to have a proper archaeological exploration of the Central Winchester Regeneration Site. Good, too, to see in the editorial that the Chronicle supports this, and hugely welcome that the editor is able to say so openly that the paper was wrong to encourage development of the previous scheme that would have resulted, as he says, in a white elephant. Professor Biddle's series of Winchester studies is internationally renowned, as is his reputation. The City Council's members and officers must surely pay attention. Everyone who wants to see a flourishing city emerge from the pandemic must hope that he will succeed where so many of us mere campaigners have so far failed. The obvious result of a thorough dig would be that the findings would dictate the development. This could mean everything from the display of an amphitheatre to, as he says in the article, new buildings designed and located so unavoidable impact, lift shafts, service trenches, and also the placing of any taller buildings and consequent design of the foundations causes the least possible disturbance. The current proposal to sell the entire site to a single developer, despite earlier plans and pleas to the contrary, would endanger such a subtle approach. A monolithic development is seldom the answer to any problem, but especially not in a city where the layers of history are so central to its personality. Archaeology aside, it's immensely depressing to learn that Winchester City Council has reverted to its initial decision some 25 years ago to ignore the adjacent areas, the central car park and the Broadway. The recognition a few years ago, possibly in the era of vastly better consultation, that the site is not actually walled off but merges with its neighbours, was significant and too important to ditch now, and that was by Judith Martin from Romsey Road, Winchester.
This is another letter relating to Professor Martin Biddle, and it's from Kim Gottlieb. Sir, Professor Martin Biddle deserves our thanks for making it plain, firstly, that the archaeology beneath Silver Hill, also known as Central Winchester Regeneration Area, is potentially very significant, and secondly, that the only way to accurately determine what it comprises and where it lies is by excavation. Chronicle, July the 15th. The Council's record on acknowledging these fundamental facts is not good. In the case of the Henderson scheme, an independent engineer's report revealed that the building's substructure would have destroyed everything that could not be removed from the site. There would have been no preservation in situ, as the Council claimed then, and which it still says it plans to achieve. More recently, the Council has suggested that there is nothing of consequence within the area, where a leading expert now says the opposite. In the prospectus given to developers, there was not a single word on the issue of archaeology, and in the papers upon which the Cabinet is presently relying to make decisions, archaeology doesn't get a mention. Because of the cost and time involved, the Council has been ducking the issue for years, but the Biddle Edict means that that is no longer possible. If it did accept the site's archaeology as its civic responsibility, the Council might appreciate that it is an asset which could support the vitality of the city centre. The Council must also appreciate that the archaeology is too important to rely on developers for its preservation. Developers have too many financial and other pressures demanding expedited solutions, i.e. shortcuts, and their focus is on the development profit, not heritage. Besides which, it will be cheaper for the Council to undertake the excavation itself, as developers would include generous provisional costs in their calculations, all of which would be deducted from any payments to the Council. The arrival of the Biddle Edict could not be more timely. The Council plans are still in an embryonic state, and there is now no excuse not to fully investigate the archaeology before the site is sold and development starts. That letter was from Keat Kim Gottlieb, East Stratton.
And Peter Smith has yet another question about Professor Biddle. Sir, I seem to remember reading in the Chronicle a few years ago Professor Biddle not supporting a proper dig on the grounds of cost. What has made him change his mind? Peter Smith, Romsey Road, Winchester.
C. Palmer writes about the South Downs Row. In response to the new draft National Planning Policy Framework, Alan Aylesbury, the chairman of the South Downs National Park Planning Committee, stated on March the 11th, "We strongly support the addition of paragraph 175 of the National Park Planning Force that any development within the setting of national parks and other sensitive landscapes should be sensitively located and designed to avoid adverse impacts on the designated landscapes." Following the South Downs National Park and Winchester City Council Planning Committee to approve this new store, as reported in last week's Chronicle, the reality could not be further from that statement and renders it little more than cynical South Downs National Park meaningless platitudes. It is incumbent upon the National Park to conserve and enhance the natural beauty, wildlife, and cultural heritage. Effectively, the Planning Committee chose to ignore significant evidence from at least 35 objectors that this application will turn a greenfield site within a national park into an industrial development. It will not create any jobs locally, and will not foster the economic and social well-being of local communities in accordance with policy South Downs 25 and South Downs 34. Despite Mr. Papp's agent for the landowner claiming only cars and vans access the site with no plans to use lorries, there is already ample evidence that lorries are accessing the site via Stakes Lane, which is designated unsuitable for HGV vehicles. Now, this has caused serious damage to the lane and remains a major concern for other road users' safety as the lorries enter and depart the B2177. The applicant failed to provide any evidence they had made inquiries to establish this shipping storage business in a more suitable urban location. This development will effectively ruin this part of the South Down National Park. The need for a strong authority committed to protecting our national parks has never been more imperative. When an authority regularly describes this and similar applications as insignificant and abdicates its responsibility to deal with these issues by routinely passing them over, it is impossible to perceive them as anything other than weak, ineffective and sanctimonious. Sadly, the South Downs National Park is giving a green light to any avaricious landowner, full speed ahead for the developmental land grab of diminishing precious environmental resources. C. Palmer, Ashton Klaus, Bishops Waltham.
Bus crash is the title of this letter from Lawrence Jones. Sir, following your report on July the 15th, it is such a terrible, tragic event for the children with life-changing injuries and their families. The bus driver responsible is being sentenced to 3 years in jail. However, no mention is made in the report of the culpability of Stagecoach, the bus operator, or the management directly involved, and the highways or council responsible for keeping the warning signs regarding height and width totally visible. Your report highlights the driver's physical and mental weaknesses, calling into question whether he should have a licence for driving a passenger bus. Also, that the driver had not been on this route before and had only partially been shown the correct route. It would have been essential he was told he should not take this amended route under the low bridge. My wife and I regularly drive on this route to Cobb's Farm Shop, and prior to the accident, the warning signs were significantly, if not totally, obstructed by overgrown trees and shrubs. Shortly after the accident, the offending vegetation was cut back to leave the road signs visible. That's from Lawrence Jones, Dean Lane, Winchester.
And Mrs. Cheryl Bard writes about Hyde Street. Sir, I understand that a decision is to be taken on July 29th about the future of the Hyde Street closure. I would ask that this closure is not permanent and that the barriers be removed at the earliest possible opportunity. Whilst it may benefit certain residents in that area, it's not been good news for other areas and has resulted in long queues forming in particularly Worthy Road and Andover Road. At the same time, it would be sensible to remove the barriers in North Walls, supposedly erected to enhance social distancing for pedestrians, who might number half a dozen on a busy day. These barriers also add congestion to Jury Street and St George's Street. With relaxation of distancing rules from July 19th, there is no need for any of these restrictions to continue. Mrs. Cheryl Barge, Burnett Close, Week, Winchester.
Now, John Beveridge writes about the diocese crisis, but there is a note from the editor that this letter was written before the bishop's retirement announcement. Your editorial comment of July the 1st is an excellent summary of the crisis facing the Winchester Diocese, and it's right in concluding that further delay in reaching a satisfactory outcome increases the damage to the diocese. When faced with a number of significant figures in the diocese supporting a synod motion expressing no confidence in the leadership of Bishop Dakin, the only way unity can be restored is by a change in the leadership of the diocese. Any other outcome could lead to structural collapse. You refer to thousands of churchgoers being treated with contempt. As one of them, I think this is an exaggeration. But sometimes it does feel that the laity are taken for granted. And what everyone needs to take into account is that the laity provide the majority of the diocese's revenue, and if there is no satisfactory resolution to the crisis by the end of August, parishes and individuals should consider whether they will continue to pay their contributions to the diocese. I, for one, will certainly do so, and when considering alternative religious bodies to support, we all need to be aware that the cathedral's finances are independent of the diocese. John Beveridge, Compton Road, Winchester.
In this letter from Mike Moore, he writes about chumocracy. Sir, congratulations to the Queen for recognising the hard work and great sacrifice of the NHS in these times of COVID. It is shameful that the Johnson government doesn't feel that NHS staff from top to bottom are deserving of, at the very minimum, a 3% rise in pay. It was the NHS that, by organising and delivering the successful vaccine rollout programme, rescued the Johnson government from its COVID failure. Instead of recognising this fact, the government, riding on the coattails of the NHS, has used the pandemic as a screen to hide their own sleazy dealings over procurement. This Johnson government defines fairness and reward as ensuring its mates, or should I say chums, are rewarded. Matt Hancock and Lord Bethell are the epitome of this chumocracy, and I can add the Conservative Party to this list, given how individual donors are rewarded with titles and businesses who donate to Conservative Party coffers with lucrative contracts. I write this letter from a personal point of view, having been in hospital very recently. I cannot thank the NHS enough or begin to express my admiration to the staff, whether it be the GP surgery at St Paul's or those at all levels at A&E and on the wards at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, who work so hard under great pressure to ensure that you are cared for, comforted and restored to health, and that they do so with grace and good humour. Yes, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Brine, they do deserve 3% and much, much more. So writes Mike Moore, Park Road, Winchester.
And Roger Farrell writes about a wall collapse. Sir, I commend Mr. Edward Fennell and the Friends of Hyde Gate in seeking to protect and enhance the beauty and historic resonance of the area, chronicled July the 8th. I have enjoyed more than 50 years of walking through the area as a pretty pathway to the city, and was saddened at the sight of the rubble and uglier barriers and signs. The immediate cause of the collapse is yet to be confirmed, though the primary cause is surely down to King Henry VIII in 1538. However, Mr. Fennell may have serendipitously hit upon the true trigger of the collapse in his casual reference to King Alfred turning in his grave. Perhaps ground-penetrating radar should be applied to the immediate vicinity to discover if this could be so. Roger Farrell, Burton Road, Hairstock, Winchester.
We're still in Hyde, but we're back on the roads again. John Rogers writes, "This situation of Hyde Street being closed has gone on for too long, as we really need to have it reopened now. It's causing real chaos. If a police car, ambulance or a fire engine on Drury Street needs to get round there, well, they can't, and this could be a life or death situation. The road narrowing has caused real problems. Southampton has taken theirs away and so has London. Someone from Hampshire County Council should stand on the corner of North Walls and see how many people ride down there. Well, it's zero. When I walk into town, I walk past that spot and I have seen nobody riding down North Walls. Pollution is getting really bad as you have cars stopped in Drury Street, City Road and Andover Road, and Stockbridge Road is jammed up. Sometimes I have traffic which goes past my house." John Rogers, Coney Green, Abbots Barton.
Keeping with the roads theme, we have a letter from Roger Stevens about Junction 9. Sir, I agree with Mr. Sharrett, Chronicle, July the 15th, that it is most agreeable to whiz past Newbury on the A34. However, whizzing on the A34 is only possible in the late evening and during the hours of darkness, when Junction 9 is not congested anyway. During the working day, the sheer volume of traffic frustrates progress. Improvements at Junction 9 will increase traffic overall and simply enable us to whiz into this milestone more quickly. If indeed the improved junction does not buckle under the increased traffic it generates. Even if successful, the remodelled junction will simply transfer the traffic congestion to road junctions elsewhere, leading to calls for yet more traffic-stimulating improvements. Looked at this way, we are the NIMBYs, aiming to transfer our traffic congestion into someone else's backyard. That letter was from Roger Stevens, Cliff Way, Compton, Winchester.
And Jeff Fowler writes about the Cowmeadow family. Sir, I wonder if any of your readers in the Overton area can help me. I'm trying to compile a family tree for the Cowmeadow family, of whom my father was a member. I did visit Rosa Cowmeadow some years ago in Overton with my father and his cousin. Rosa was the widow of Harold Cowmeadow, and if I remember rightly, they had two sons who ran a butcher's shop. I'd love to hear from anyone who's related to them. Harold was the brother of my grandmother, and they were just two of 15 siblings. Jeff Fowler, Old Kennels Lane, Oliver's Battery, Winchester.
Peggy Souter writes Butcher Leaves. Your article in last week's Chronicle about Glenn Davis leaving to start a new venture in Wales was rather misleading. Glenn is indeed leaving, but his colleague, Julian, will still be selling meat from the van in Winchester Market on Middlebrook Street, and hopefully his customers will still be buying there. Peggy Souter, Kingsgate Road, Winchester.
Great. And now, Heather, you're going to read an alternative look at the news with Belgurum Dari.
Protecting the Cathedral. There is no need to panic if you saw fire engines at Winchester Cathedral last Tuesday. Firefighters were out in the heat, servicing the hose at the city's biggest building. Spectators stood by two engines, partially blocked off the close to ensure the hose was up to scratch. Posting to Twitter, Winchester Fire Station said, "Winchester and St Mary's crews, servicing the hose used to protect Winchester Cathedral, making full use of the long-reach fire engine testing and maintaining our kit is such an important part of what we do. There are only two places where the chief fire officer must be alerted to emergencies 24 hours, 7 days a week. They are Fawley Oil Refinery and the cathedral." Mm. And the second Balgaram piece is about wildflowers being saved on Grass Verge. You may have noticed this. Credit where credit is due. We hear a lot about inconsiderate contractors cutting wildflowers growing on grass verges before they have a chance to set seed. David Linney recognised the emergence of wildflowers on a verge in Westman Road in Wick, including blue cornflowers, Centaurtia cyanus, and blue viper's bug bugloss, Echemium vulgare. Mr Linney, a botany graduate, told Belgarum it must be 70 years or more since this was arable land. The seed must have lain dormant over this period of time, and fearful that the flowers would be swiped away, he spoke to the contractors from Idverd, working in the areas for the city council. The workmen left the patch, meaning the flowers should return next year. Well done, Idverd. The city council has a policy of minimising grass cutting and also encourages wildflowers as part of its biodiversity plan.
And this week's first person is by Khalid Aziz and is read by John.
Thank you. And I beg your pardon. This piece by Khalid Aziz is entitled Taking the Knee. There's nothing new about taking the knee. Catholics have been doing it for centuries. They call it genuflection, and it's supposed to demonstrate obeisance to the Almighty. When professional footballers do it, they are demonstrating against what they understandably perceive as the injustice of racism. Is it a gesture? Of course it is, but it's up to them, and they shouldn't be booed for it. Booing, as far as we know, goes back at least as far as the Romans. It's an easy way of expressing dissent. Personally, I find it vapid and fatuous, as it allows people the anonymity of the mob as they engage in an act they wouldn't want to be seen doing as individuals, just like internet trolls. It's cowardly. I was horrified some years ago now to hear booing at Lourdes, of all places. Why are they booing Joe Root, the then future England captain? It was patiently explained that the noise was not, in fact, denigration, but a celebration of his name, as in Root. We've come a long way since this young reporter was in a BBC newsroom. Yes, a BBC newsroom, regularly instructed to get your black arse over here by a senior presenter. No one batted an eyelid. Just banter. Try that today and you'd be marched off for a little Xi Jinping-style re-education, courtesy of a court of unconscious bias. I, of course, would be offered counselling. Gone are the days, too, when at Hampshire drinks parties, old buffers would think they were paying me a compliment by remarking on what a great command I had of English, given your background. Perhaps my command of the English language has slipped, but I hope it's because it's no longer unusual, or even better, people realise that background has little to do with intrinsic ability. So, am I wholeheartedly behind our genuflecting footballers? No, not entirely. Football has so many things to put in order in its own house before it starts to lecture the rest of us. On the field, it's a filthy game. I asked my football-mad son-in-law to explain the rules around physicality. He made a brave attempt, but gave up quite quickly. Basically, all manner of thuggery is permitted as long as the referee either doesn't see it or chooses not to blow his whistle. Sometimes because he's been intimidated to a level not witnessed in any other sport. Then there's the gamesmanship, with every professional match containing more dives than a Jacques Cousteau documentary. Time to be controversial.
What?
To my untutored eye, the penalty created by the recent canonised Raheem Sterling against the Danes in the semi-final was the result of a clear dive. We were lucky to make the final, and although we were a plucky team, Italy were clearly better. It happens. Get over it. Build on the experience. Off the field, it's bad too. Friends who attended the final at Wembley said there was precious little checking of the double jabbed or COVID negative. How could there be when there was a drunken, baying mob rushing to get in for free? The Met have issued photos of 10 persons of interest. Why stop there? How about expelling those so-called fans who persistently booed opposition national anthems? It's the vocal equivalent to flag burning and should be treated as such. It's certainly not sporting. Meanwhile, the footballing blazerati continue to smile while raking in the cash generated by duped fans. Overpaid players create, as role models, impossible aspirations for adoring youngsters who are inevitably set up to fail. In Gareth Southgate, we have hope, as he appears to be a true gent. Perhaps it's now time for his players to get up off their knees and pray that their footballing masters bring about real change. I'm not holding my breath.
And I've got the editorial comment on Hyde Street, too high a price to pay, it says. The closure of Hyde Street has been the most contentious road closure since that of College Street and Kingsgate Arch in the early 1990s. Hampshire County Council is set to make a decision on July 29th. The County Council is Conservative controlled, and the City Council, which supports the closure experiment, is run by the Lib Dems. Both appear to favour the closure, which was introduced when central government gave some money for COVID social distancing measures last year. The Hyde Street closure is needed to enable North Walls to be reduced to a single lane, freeing up more space for people to stay 2 metres apart. The Chronicle believes that whilst anything to help social distancing, questionable in this case, is laudable, the price being paid in increased congestion on surrounding roads is too high. Some might say that the COVID social distancing explanation is a smokescreen for the real reason, which is to try to deter car usage in the city centre. The residents of Hyde Street will be unhappy to lose their much quieter road, but the impact elsewhere of continuing closure makes that a luxury. And now I've got the lighting up times to tell you about. On Wednesday, the 28th of July, it ends at 5:25 a.m. and begins at 8:27 p.m. And here's Heather with Letter from Westminster.
Winchester MP Steve Brine writes the letter from Westminster this week. Parliament has, in the past week, debated a major new health and care bill, and I was pleased to make a contribution. I highlighted the need to address long-term structural gaps in staffing, to back up commitments made in the NHS 10-year plan, and to tackle the NHS COVID backlog. We have years of workforce challenge to face. I called for a requirement, on the face of the bill, on the government to publish modelling of the future supply of the entire health and care workforce. And I reiterated my belief in an immigration policy that recognises, not curtails, the new unique circumstances across health and social care. On primary care, I welcomed the formal creation of the new integrated care systems, which will remove the silos that exist within the NHS while supporting it, local authorities, and the wider system to join up services, and said we need them to realise their potential quickly. What do I mean by that? Well, in part, general practice needs to embrace the wider primary care family, and that means realising the potential of community pharmacy, ophthalmology and dental services as vehicles of prevention as much as treatment. And moving upstream of the bill, I was clear it has to be all about prevention. We hear regularly now talk of a waiting list touching 13 million people, and we must tackle that. But we hear less of addressing poor health at source. So I support measures to face up to the obesity challenge, driving as it is incidences of cancer, heart disease and diabetes. It's no use throwing the nanny state line at proponents of this argument anymore, as regularly happened when I was the minister. We have a government that has, until recently, made it illegal to leave the country, and took a view on whether you could dance at a wedding, to protect the National Health Service. So don't tell me we can't help people live healthier lives through a focus on prevention. Obesity is one example. Smoking is another. It remains the biggest preventable killer in our country today. We can wear a mask around a virus in a largely vaccinated population, but we sell cigarettes over the counter every day. And some people make a lot of money as a result. We need a revised and updated tobacco control plan alongside these health reforms, or we will never realise our smoke-free ambition by 2030, as per the policy I set back in 2017. And finally, I have been very active in Parliament and on the media, scrutinising the end of lockdown, well, sort of, as we moved past 19th of July and step four of the roadmap. In my opinion, the real issue, one of the issues of our time, is not this law or that regulation or piece of advice. It is whether we really mean it when we say we must learn to live with COVID. I predict many battles to come, as some find it harder to let go of the almighty state telling us what we can and cannot do than they might like to admit. Either we believe in our COVID vaccines or we do not. We should tread carefully for sure. But it's time to end the pingdemic that is often illogical, seldom fair, and the opposite of following the science.
Now we'll continue with further items of general news, starting with one read by John.
And the article I'm starting with is Bishop Set to Retire After Stepping Back. The Bishop of Winchester has announced his retirement after stepping back for months. Right Reverend Dr. Tim Dakin has formally notified his intention to officially retire in February 2022. As previously reported, there has been a series of conversations to consider matters raised concerning leadership and governance. Many church people are unhappy at Bishop Tim's management style over the last decade. It has seen an emphasis on mission work whilst cutting back traditional village posts. One local churchman, who asked not to be named, said, "The overwhelming feeling will be one of relief." In a video message, Bishop Tim said, "I have now received confirmation that Her Majesty the Queen has accepted my retirement as bishop. I wanted you all to hear my decision as directly as possible, and doing it this way rather speaks to our times. Some formalities and details need to be finalised, but I'll be leaving the diocese in early February and handing over my responsibilities to others in the meantime. Please pray for all involved in this transition process." Mahatma Gandhi said that unity to be real must stand the severest strain without breaking. "I have always been clear that as your bishop, I should be there to build and foster togetherness across our diocese, focused upon our life together in Christ and upon our joint mission to serve Christ in our communities and to sustain Christian witness in daily life. Sadly, it seems it is no longer possible for me to fulfil this role. The last 18 months have brought enormous pressure to bear on us all, individually, as a country, within our families and communities, and as a diocese. The painfully difficult financial decisions made over the last year have caused real anguish. In trying to secure a sustainable future for the growth of the diocese, it is clear that I've not done enough to acknowledge what we have lost in this process. To those I've hurt or let down, I am sorry." The Bishop of Southampton, Debbie Sellin, will continue to fulfil Bishop Tim's duties following the recent announcement that he would step back until the end of August. "I realise that the steps taken to stabilise the finances continue to cause upset," he continued. "Bishop's Council has received full reports in recent weeks from the diocesan auditors and legal advisers, explaining and corroborating the decisions made by the Diocesan Board of Finance. None of this makes those decisions any easier to take. Nevertheless, I hope there is some comfort in the clarity now provided and that faith can be restored in the relevant diocesan staff and functions as the pastoral reorganisations proceed. Please continue to pray for all those involved. Pray too for all serving in the parishes and various projects, that the church and its witness may grow in the diocese. I could not have come to my decision, or indeed found a way through this recent period, without the love and support of Sally, my children, and close friends. While I have not seen much of what has been said about me, my family and friends have seen more, and I have seen the effect it has had on them. They are the people who know me best, of course, and I've drawn upon their love and their view of me during these difficult times. It has been a privilege to serve a diocese that has companion links across the world. I've been reminded of previous ministry experience, of the need to live on other people's terms, to see the world they see, and to know the Christ they follow. I hope these links will continue to grow in strength and in significance. It's also been a great joy to be part of a diocese where education is taken seriously at all levels.
Fight to stop new homes continues. Mitchell Deaver Parish Council has repeated its support for affordable housing on a former garage court in the village, but the scheme continues to be opposed by neighbours. Winchester City Council has submitted an application to demolish the garages in Southbrook Cottages and construct a two-storey development containing four one-bedroom and two two-bedroom apartments within a two-storey building, which will meet Passive House standards. Passive House is the leading international low-energy design standard. Over 65,000 buildings have been designed, built and tested to this standard worldwide. On July the 8th, the Parish Council published a notice clarifying how the application will be decided and how people can comment, but it also repeated its support for the scheme. The authority said the Parish Council have decided, after improvements were made to the parking provision at Southbrook Cottages, to comment in support of the planning application due to the need for small affordable homes for local people. A housing needs survey report last year identified 20 households with local connection to Mitchell Deaver Parish who have been assessed by the City Council as needing rented social housing. 12 of these require one-bed properties and 5 require two-bed properties, whilst 3 need larger properties. But the scheme has been criticised by residents, with many writing to the City Council to object to the scheme and a petition with various names submitted. During a consultation last year, site neighbours expressed concerns over parking and the loss of privacy. The council has since tried to appease residents by introducing more parking spaces in the street, but concerns remain. Site neighbours Amanda Hall and Richard Odom said, "I appreciate you are trying to appease residents in increasing the current car parking in the street. The additional parking will relieve the current situation. However, with the development of additional dwellings, the street will be more congested than it is currently." They added, "This design is hideous and not in keeping with the village. One would assume construction of a traditional dwelling in keeping with the village would be more acceptable. The development of a tin-roof dwelling will be a blot on the landscape, as it looks more like an industrial unit. It would surely be more in keeping with in a less rural setting." The council's planning website listed an internal target date for a decision to be made as on July the 15th, but no outcome has yet been made. To view the plans, visit the City Council planning portal on its website and search for the reference 21-01279-FUL. I'll say that again, 21-01279-FUL.
Green-fingered guides and rangers, tidy prison garden. Winchester Prison's Memorial Garden was given a makeover thanks to the help of a group of youngsters. Kingsworthy guides and rangers answered a call on social media for tools and plants to cheer up the area, but decided to go a step further. The girls used their meeting time to create somewhere for people to gather or have lunch. Businesses came together and donated plants and flowers from Brambridge Garden Centre, Hilliers, the original flower stall and Homebase. Social media was a big help, with the guide leaders spending most of the Sunday before that week's meeting driving around Winchester collecting donations from people's gardens. Each guide and ranger also brought something to plant, from bright-coloured dahlias to shrubs and herbs. The 40 girls and their leaders spent the first 45 minutes in year group bubbles pulling out weeds and ivy and pruning back shrubs and trees. They collected over 20 sacks of garden waste and found old bricks and litter. After a swift drink and biscuit, girls then sorted the gifted plants into colours and began digging. Ranger Beck said, "I've never planted this many flowers before. We had to learn about digging a deep enough hole and giving plants enough space. Actually, it looks beautiful. The garden will be used by prison staff on their breaks, as well as families as they wait to see loved ones." Leader Isabel Haig said, "We are so proud of how the girls rose to the challenge in such a short space of time. With some determination, passion and creativity, things can be achieved."
A departure to remember for pupils leaving school. An Alsford school has given its leaving pupils a departure to remember. Teachers at Sun Hill Junior School helped organise a leavers week for Year 6 pupils to secondary school. Rather than organising a typical residential at a specific venue, the staff decided to take matters into their own hands and put on a week of many different activities and adventures. Parent Nikki Gower said, "The effort and dedication the staff of Sun Hill Juniors have shown our children this week has been exceptional. We could not have asked for more. At a time of limitations, when our children have been unable to socialise, get out and about and experience new things, the staff went out of their way to make Leavers Week all the bigger, brighter and more enjoyable for our Year Sixes. From the bottom of our hearts, we thank you for helping them make so many special memories." The children spent 2 days doing outdoor pursuits, including paddleboarding, abseiling, firelighting, camouflage racing at Fairthorne Manor, followed by a day at Chessington World of Adventures, then a sports and creative arts day run by specialists at school. This was followed by a movie premiere night watching their own Year 6 Leavers production. The events culminated in a camp out on the school field with a posh barbecue. Joshua Gower, age 11, said, "This was the best week ever. I can't believe how many activities our teachers organised for us in 1 week. I'm sad that this is our last week at Sun Hill Juniors, but I'm so lucky to have gone here." Amelia Lakeman, also 11, said, "It was amazing. We had so many laughs and made so many memories." Freddie Williams, 11, said, "The teachers gave us something different than we've done before, and they all joined in too. The teachers gave us something different than we've done before, and they all joined in." Dylan Clark said, "It was the best week of school I've ever had. The teachers were kind and looked out for me, and I'm really thankful they made it such an amazing week." And there are two photographs accompanying this article. One is of these particular Year 6s all sitting around. It looks as though they're eating burgers or something. Maybe that was from the posh barbecue. I don't know. And then there's another one of their smiling faces giving a thumbs up to the camera as they prepare for secondary school.
And memories of Arabian service. Life is very different these days for Bishop's Waltham resident Robert Shields. He's lived in the town for 20 years since his retirement and plays a full part in the community as a minibus driver, community first responder and organiser of town team events. But before the formation of the United Arab Emirates in 1971, a small army funded by Britain kept the peace across the original seven sheikdoms. The Trucial Oman Scouts, led by British officers, was joined by Mr. Shields in 1966, who served with them for nearly a year before attending university. This was before the oil had brought its wealth, before roads were built, and before tourists had arrived. The traditional Arab way of life was ubiquitous. Mr. Shields of Hoe Road has now written a book on his experiences. For nearly 365 days, he served in remote outposts, leading patrols into the desert, and negotiating in Arab with local emirs to keep the peace. He was given an Arabic name, Rashid, which means the infallible tutor. Every few days he wrote letters home to his parents and his future wife, Ruth. He wrote as events unfurled, recording impressions. My insight of politics and of people may have been limited at the start, but as my knowledge of the Arabic language grew, so did my confidence, said the former parish councillor. And there's a lovely picture of him in the 1960s, standing on looks like a rock in the desert, with wearing a sort of British uniform, but a typical Arab headdress, looking very Lawrence of Arabia.
Sage of Long Parish, John Woodcock, dies. And there's a picture of him smiling, clearly on the boundary of a cricket field. John Woodcock, OBE, the legendary cricket correspondent of the Times from 1954 to 1988 and editor of Wisden for six editions between 1981 and 86, has died at his Long Parish home, aged 94. He had a lifetime association with Long Parish cricket as a player, administrator and a keen supporter, writes Chris Stacani from Long Parish City County. From Long Parish CC. Sage of Long Parish, John Woodcock, dies. John Woodcock, OBE, the legendary cricket correspondent of the Times from 1954 to 1988 and editor of Wisden for six editions between 1981 and 86, has died at his Long Parish home, aged 94. He had a lifetime association with Long Parish cricket as a player, administrator and keen supporter, writes Chris Stacani from Long Parish Cricket Club. He regularly assembled sides sprinkled with stars to take on the Long Parish side, with Dennis Compton, Richie Benno, Colin Cowdrey and many others turning out. Before he passed away, Ken Ball, who had a 60-year association of his own with the club, talked of the time he was bowled by Frank Typhoon Tyson by a ball that he didn't see. More recently, John hosted a match between Long Parish and a touring side of retired state and grade cricketers from New South Wales and Australia Capital Territory, who were all keen to meet the Sage of Long Parish, as he was often called. John was also present when Long Parish twice reached the final of the Cricket Cup, travelling to play at Lord's. Up until the last year, he would drop into the ground for a few hours to see how the game was going, invariably with a copy of the Times, before disappearing for a pint at the Plough or the Cricketers. He had a fund of tales on cricket, and much more beside, and loved nothing more than a chat on the boundary. As happy talking about the trials of touring test cricket before air travel, he sailed to Australia four times and once to South Africa between 1950 and 1963, as he was on the performance of the Long Parish under-11s in their latest match. He was a great supporter of the youth teams, delighting in any youngster who demonstrated an ability for the game. Often he would arrive at the ground with some visiting friend from the press box in tow, the late West Indies player and broadcaster Tony Crozier, Vic Marks, Mike Atherton, Jim Maxwell and many more have parked themselves on a bench at Long Parish in recent times chatting with John. He was also a very keen countryman, skilled fly fisherman who fished the River Test throughout his life. He shot and took a great interest in the natural environment and the people who worked in the valley where he spent all his life, as well as being a very keen golfer. John will be greatly missed by everyone at Long Parish Cricket Club and everyone who lives in the village. His influence throughout his life on the Cricket Cup and this part of the Test Valley will be remembered for a very long time.
Police boss hails success of action against pony racing. Hampshire's new police boss says she wants to see more emphasis on tackling antisocial behaviour and general lawlessness. Donna Jones was speaking in the wake of Operation Gossamer to investigate illegal pony and trap racing after a weekend of racing on the A33 near Mitchell Dever. further planned events by the travellers have been stopped. Police Crime Commissioner Ms. Jones said, "These races are highly lucrative, with large sums of money being made from illegal gambling and horses being raced in poor conditions. They are not only dangerous, but create fear and disturbance in local communities who have to contend not only with roads being closed, but potentially with the impact of having a large number of travellers camping illegally in their communities." One such event took place in May, with over 500 travellers closing a road, which prevented people leaving their homes or being able to access them. "The police supported me in taking these threats seriously, and to their credit, stood up to a successful operation. The constabulary put a significant number of officers on the operation, and the races did not go ahead. I want to see greater priority given to antisocial behaviour and to general lawlessness. Dealing fairly with illegal horse races and travel encampments is very much a part of that."
A delayed walk around wartime Winchester. It's better late than never. Winchester tourist guides Colin Cook and Patrick Craze were unable to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Victory in Europe Day last year because of COVID. But now they can offer the tour on Saturday, August the 7th. It will chart the story of the war as it affected the city, from the threat of nightly bombing raids and the loss of loved ones in far-off lands, and the shelter provided to bombed-out children from Portsmouth and Southampton, the guides will set the scene in their walk around the city. They will be passing places where Winchester's men and women made their contribution to the war effort, not least the design and production of the iconic Spitfire, and where Allied armies were billeted and trained for D-Day. Patrick and Colin will be aided by four Wintonians who grew up in wartime Winchester and will give accounts of events that happened both tragic and triumphant. The photograph that's accompanying this story shows three of those, Tony Dowland, Phil Yates and Derek Best, in front of the Northgate House in Jury Street, once the regional HQ for the Royal Observer Corps. The tour will end with an account of the celebrations that took place around the city on VE Day and afterwards.
Fury over felling of mature woodland. A tree cutter, when asked for his licence, brandished his chainsaw, saying, "This is my licence." The chopping down of scores of trees in a Hampshire wood has angered local people. Men with chainsaws have spent several days cutting down mature trees at Woodside Caravan Park, just off the A32 at West Tisted, near Ropley. Neighbours say the authorities have been alerted, but nothing has been done to stop the destruction of around 20 acres. The Forestry Commission said it had launched an investigation into the felling. One processor said the new owner of the site was asked to stop, but carried on cutting down trees. One neighbour, who asked not to be named, said the felling started on Saturday, July the 10th. The trees were felled over a public footpath which was not closed, and when I confronted them for access and said, "You need a licence," they threatened me by waving a chainsaw, saying that was their licence. It was switched off at the time. I phoned the Health and Safety Executive, police, Forestry Commission, East Hampshire Planning Authority, South Downs National Park Planning Authority, and the lack of response so far has been shocking. The only people trying to help are the Highways Council contact and the Parish Council and local community. More destruction happens daily. They cut a lady's fence with horses in the field to get access, and they flattened another lady's electric fence where she had run her ducks. I am devastated. I just took a walk along the footpath now. It's like a war scene and someone blew it all up. It is unclear if any action has been taken. A recent planning appeal over lawful existing use was settled, but it is unclear whether the felling has breached planning rules. West Tisted Parish Council has asked for information from the District Council. A Forestry Commission spokesperson said today, "We take protecting all trees and woodlands extremely seriously and won't hesitate to investigate any allegations of illegal tree felling. If there's no felling licence or other valid permission in place, or if the wrong trees are felled, anyone involved can be prosecuted. We're aware of reports of alleged illegal felling near Monkwood and have opened an investigation into these allegations. As this is an ongoing investigation, we cannot offer any further comment. The wood clearance follows something similar at Scorey's Copse at Horton Heath, near Eastleigh in April, which was widely condemned. Before anyone can cut down trees legally, they need to get a felling licence from the Forestry Commission, and depending on whether an exemption to the need for a licence applies. In addition to a felling licence, other permissions to fell the trees may also be required, and there are further details available. Felling trees without the authority of a required licence currently carries a penalty upon conviction in a magistrate's court of £2,500 or twice the value of the timber felled. Provisions within the Environment Bill, which is currently before Parliament, will increase this penalty to an unlimited fine set at the discretion of the court. The Forestry Commission can serve a restocking notion upon the individual responsible, ordering them to plant trees. A spokesman for East Hampshire District Council said, "I can tell you that our arboricultural team were not consulted as part of the planning process, and they have not had any involvement in the site before last week when it was brought to our attention. The trees were not subject to a tree protection order." In a statement, the South Downs National Park said, "We're aware of a number of trees that have been removed at this location. East Hampshire District Council tree officers, acting on behalf of the South Downs National Park Authority, were notified of the tree removal and promptly carried out an assessment at the site. An initial assessment concluded that none of the trees had statutory protection in terms of planning enforcement, either from being a tree preservation order or that being in a conservation area. So the tree removal is now under investigation by the Forestry Commission and has also been reported to the police's wildlife crime unit."
Taking on the Three Castles. A group of eight, including two canines, ran 100 kilometres between Three Castles. James Marshall, alongside five of his friends and two dogs, took to the Three Castles path that connects Windsor to Winchester via Odiham. Finishing in their home city, the team ran 50 kilometres a day across 2 days, unsupported apart from visiting two pop-up cafes. Mr. Marshall told the Chronicle, "The route is a little more Spartan as you come down the Candover Valley. We do all live in Kingsworthy, so it was superb to finish such an epic route in our home city. This we all did to raise funds for the Samaritans and so far have raised in excess of £2,000.
And I'm afraid that concludes the extracts for the week ending the 23rd of July 2021. Thanks to our editors, Sonia Phillips, Sheila Shepherd and Sheila Shepard. Thanks to our copying and dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks to today's readers, Heather Thorpe-Tracy.
Goodbye.
John Richards.
Goodbye.
And from me, Noel Thorpe-Tracy. Thank you for listening. Goodbye for now, and I hope you stay safe and well in the week ahead. When you've finished with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet. And please place the correct address label on the front of the wallet too, and return the wallet as soon as possible. Thank you, and goodbye again.